Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and usually joining me today would be my co-host, Steve Jones Jr., but Steve had a bit of business pop up right before we recorded. So no Steve today. He'll be back on the next episode. No problems. Everything's good. We would be getting the abbreviated intro from Steve anyway, as we have not just one guest, but two guests today. Joining us to talk about what is currently the best team in the NBA right now, the Cleveland Cavaliers, we have the Chase Down crew back with us today. We have Justin Rowan, Carter Rodriguez. Fellas, first and foremost, Happy New Year. Second, how the heck are y'all doing?
I'm doing great, man. Things are fun. The Cavs have the best record in the NBA. That's, that's the perfect way to end 2024. It's been a lot of fun and, knock on wood, they've managed to stay healthy. That seems to be one of the kind of biggest themes when you look at the last couple of years of Cleveland Cavaliers basketball. But when you look at them playing, 28 minutes a night, a lot of times when it comes to the starters, you feel good about at least the wear and tear effect on the body.
Yeah, I'm doing great. I was doing better until Steve ghosted us. You say everything's all good. Ain't good over here, Steve. Ducking us.
I maintain that he knew that I was going to come for him because he didn't have Garland on his All-Star team.
Unbelievable. Where with
he
the
knew
right
what
half.
Agenda Let's I'm here that. To push. He knew what agendas I push. He knew exactly what he's seen my movies over the years, and he found a way to get out of it.
Yeah, we're with the respectful half of the Dunker Spot, as far as I'm concerned.
Wow. Well, Steve, it would appear that you have some things to answer for when you return. So we will keep that on the ledger. But let's get right into the Cavs. Quick tale of the tape. They are 21-4 as of recording, 17-1 at home, 12-3 on the road.
29-4.
29. Ah, did I miss that?
You know, when you have that many wins, it's easy to misplace eight.
Yeah, it's kind of all, it's a big pile and a little pile.
There we go. 29-4. Excuse me. Still 17-1 at home, 12-3 on the road. Not just the best offensive rating in the league, but the best offensive rating in NBA history as of now. Did that one for you, Steve. Just on a general note before we dig into the nuts and bolts of this, I'll start with you with this, Carter. How surprised are you that the Cavs are this level of good?
I mean, I'm very surprised, and that is not for like either of us being low on this team coming into the year. Last year was a bad vibes year, I think it just didn't feel like they were ever much more than the sum of their parts last year, which was kind of a departure in my opinion from the years prior, and you come off that Knicks series loss and then you have a weird regular season where everyone's hurt all year. Darius is just completely snake bitten and isn't the player that we knew him to be the 2 years prior. Evan is hurt all year, and as a result, it kind of looks like a bit of a stagnation year. Then, you can just tell there's a little bit of coach fatigue, and this is, this is a JB Bickerstaff, supporting group, I would say, the three of us. We all think he's a good coach, but there are all sometimes where things just kind of flip. So I don't know. It was one of those, I felt really good about the team just because I didn't think they were going to be so hurt. And I thought all their young dudes would get a little bit better. Was I expecting a 72 win pace through 33 games almost halfway through the year? I just don't think anyone could. I think Justin picked 54 wins. I picked 55.
No, it was the other way around. I'm the more optimistic of the two. Let's be real here.
I mean, both of us predicted six wins better than the over-under was set at. But no, I just couldn't have seen this coming. Every year when you're previewing the season, you're trying to identify all the things that might go better than the year before, all the things that might not be as good as the year before. I didn't expect every single thing that might get better to get better and everything that might get worse not to get worse.
Yeah, that was basically, coming into the season when we did our season preview podcast, I said that this was the first year in a long time that I felt the Cavs have a legitimate chance to win a championship. I said, that might be just a 5% chance. And what that percentage is basically going to be based on how many of these X factors hit. Can Garland, you know, I think what happened last year was mostly the result of health. But when you kind of have, you know, that negative muscle memory, sometimes it's tough to regain that chemistry, right? Sometimes it's tough to regain that trust of your teammates. Can Mobley take the step forward? And, you know, as Carter said, I think we correctly kind of outlined what all the X factors were. It's just like, it's really, really hard to, you know, even as an optimistic analyst, to say all of this is going to hit. Because usually guys having success is going to take something away from someone else. I didn't think it was possible for Evan Mobley to make a leap. Garland to not only get back to the form that he was in the past, but, you know, play at a career best level. I didn't think all that was possible while still getting a step forward from Isaac Okoro. For Ty Jerome to step up as a sixth man. For Ty Jerome to step up as a great sixth man. And Caris LeVert to arguably have the best season he's ever had, right? Like,
dude, fundamentally changed his entire career shot profile in one offseason.
And for all of that to happen with Donovan Mitchell and Jared Allen still being incredibly productive and incredibly efficient and having great years themselves, like, even as a optimist that has, you know, wine and gold colored glasses and you know, loves to not hide the fact that I'm a homer, I couldn't have predicted all of that hitting.
Like, I was thinking about it earlier today where I was pretty high on Cleveland coming into the year. Like, we did our season prediction pod. I had Cleveland as the 2 seed. I had Kenny Atkinson as the coach of the year. Had Evan Mobley as the DPOY. I figured Darius Garland's going to be better. And I still feel like I'm just wrong about Cleveland.
Yeah. I mean,
even with them being this good, like, it's
it is truly, I mean, it is an unprecedented run, you know, for a team, especially like, you know, I mean, the only comp I can really think about for a team with this much top end talent having a start like this, I keep going back to those 2015 Warriors, where you make a coaching change, and you know, a couple of the young guys really take off, and then all of a sudden you're just a whole different thing than you were. You had all the bones, because you look at the, you know, the 2014 Warriors to the 2015 Warriors. They were a little different, but, you know, a lot of it was still that same core. You know, they added Iggy, I think, that summer. Yeah. But, like, you know, a lot of it was the guys they already had just going up 7 notches. And you went from pretty good, respectable team to Death Star. And, like, I kind of feel like the Cavs have done a similar thing here.
Yeah, and one of the things we talked about as well is that, you know, we felt that Kenny Atkinson was going to make a difference, that there was going to be a change to the offense. But one of the things we said is, you know, the baseline was probably higher than people realize, because 2 years ago, they were, you know, the 7th best offense in the league. They were an elite defense. They were a 51 win team. And I felt, you know, even in the preseason, it looked like Garland was ready to take a step forward, that he had, you know, bulked up his body. He was willing to take more threes. And then, you know, there's a hamstring injury. There's a shooting hand injury. By the time that starts getting better and he's back to himself, he breaks his jaw. Evan Mobley has the injury. Donovan Mitchell starts the year with a hamstring injury and then doesn't play post All-Star break. Like, it's almost like the 2014-15 Warriors had a bunch of injuries and we didn't get to see the step forward from Draymond and Klay. And instead, we just kind of skipped that year and went to 2015-16. We just went straight to 15-16. And, you know, this is going to have the cadence of a joke. And in some ways it is, because I just can't help myself. But I'm starting to understand this team playing at a 72 win pace. I get why that year drives them so nuts, because this is the most fun that I've had watching a basketball team winning at this type of clip. I know how fun it is to come back from down 3-1. You combine winning at a 70 win pace, a 3-1 comeback, and then you have the biggest finals collapse in NBA history. That would probably haunt me for the rest of my life. Like, this is Warriors so much fans, fun.
I bet you weren't expecting a strag today, but we're throwing them at you.
They saw the name in the description. They knew what was coming.
Literally from the chase down. Like, I think they...
Yeah, they're fine now.
Yeah.
You know what you signed up for. But I guess we could start there with the offense, with the guards in particular. Like, I feel like, to your point, Justin, Darius Garland bouncing back to this degree. Like, I wouldn't argue that he's Cleveland's best player, but that feels like the biggest swing to them becoming this.
Yeah.
in being able to shift the offense the way they have. Not that it's a full wholesale change. Like, they haven't invented bigs bringing the ball up the floor, using their bigs as hub or running high pick and roll. But Darius Garland not only getting back to the healthier version of himself, but being like 10% more aggressive. Yeah. I am hunting these pull-up threes. I am hunting these pull-ups. It just helps unlock everything else because you know he has the off-ball stuff. He's fine with playing off and catching the ball and moving, attacking from there. The fact that he's taking more command of this offense without it, to your earlier point, taking other things off the table for everyone else, it's been so huge for what Cleveland is.
And I think it's just created a healthier ecosystem. Donovan Mitchell is always going to be the leading play finisher. You know, he is such a phenomenal scorer, and he's been... You know, his efficiency has gone through the roof since he's come to Cleveland. And I think playing off of Garland is a big part of that. But when you look at the 22-23 season, the difference between Darius being on court versus off court in terms of offensive rating was the difference between the 29th offense and a top three offense. The biggest difference between this year and that year is the floor's higher, right? Like instead of, you know, one of the worst offenses in the league to one of the best, we have a very strong offense when he's off the court, right? Like they still, you know, 113, it's middle of the pack. It's not exceptional, but it's still very good. The difference is it's a 124.6 offensive rating when he is on the court. And, you know, obviously he gets to play with Donovan Mitchell and they are phenomenal together. It's a 121 offensive rating when they're together. But I think what makes the Cavs
better with Donovan off just shows you how good Garland's been.
Yeah, you know, as you said, this is the best offense in NBA history to this point. When Donovan Mitchell is off the court and it's just Darius Garland, they have a 130.7 offensive rating per cleaning the glass. And that's almost 800 possessions. Like, this isn't a small sample. And I think that's what makes the Cavs so difficult is their primary configurations are the core four together, which if you look at that lineup when they're playing with a small forward, they have a plus 12.3 net rating. When it's just Garland and Allen, one of their primary, you know, one of the other looks they go to after that, it's a plus 11.2. When it's Mitchell and Mobley, it's 15.7. Like, they are able to have one of those combinations on the court at all times, and all of them are dominant. I think that's what makes them so difficult, because it's not like playing a Jokic or a Giannis where when they're off the court, you have a little bit of breathing room. Maybe you can make up some ground. They're able to come at you for 48 minutes if they have to.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately, like, what Darius returning to form means is you're just kind of back to 48 minutes of hell playing against this team. Like, there just aren't soft spots in the rotation, or, you know, almost every team in the league has, you know, one or two rotations a game where you go, all right, you're going to have to survive for 4 minutes. Like, please, this lineup never does what the Cavs just don't have that, you know? And I think Darius being, you know, to lock in on him, to your original question, I just think he's always been the ceiling raiser for this offense before Donnie got here. And even after Donnie got here, he is the guy that, cause he's just the best playmaker on the team. I mean, I think that's not in question. He is a true point guard. You can always tell who doesn't watch the Cavs, depending on whether they describe Darius Garland as a scoring guard or not. Because if you watch the Cavs, you know that Cavs fans beg him to shoot more all the time because he's so obsessed with creating for others. But he is the kind of the guy who gets teams in the blender, the guy who can change the rhythm of the game and find guys, you know, that one beat earlier, that one beat later than the defense is expecting, and find an angle. So the playmaking's always been there. Even last year, the playmaking was there. But because he's got his burst back, because his condition's back, the turnovers are down. The scoring in the paint has been unbelievable. You know, he is finally, I think he's kind of finally hit the right equilibrium as an attacker where he doesn't do the over penetrate and try to finish at an insane angle. Using glass, like he's gotten a lot more comfortable using the short floater. You know, these aren't 14, 15 foot floaters. They're 8 to 12 foot floaters. And I think those are really, you know, there's a really huge difference in terms of shot profile and, you know, your point expected points on those kind of floaters when you've got touch like he has. You know, he was one of the most blocked players in the league last year at the rim. You know, he was just constantly taking that one extra step in and he's not big. And frankly, he's not that explosive either. So like, if you don't have a step, you got to do the Steve Nash loop around, because he doesn't have the kind of gifts other players have athletically to get through that. So I think he's done a much better job of hunting those kind of shots. But most importantly, Akaiz, he's taking threes. He's finally taking yes. threes. He is up to 8.2 3-point attempts per 36 minutes. You got to use only pace adjusted or minute adjusted stats with any Cavalier, because they're all ruined, because no one plays 30 minutes every night. But you know, last year he was at 6.7. The year prior he was at 6.1. He's really not a high volume 3-point shooter for how good of a shooter he is. And what we've been begging for years and years and years, and what JB Bickerstaff begged, what Darius's trainers and off seasons have begged, what Darius himself has said he needs to do, is shoot more threes. Because ultimately, you know, I always go back to this, you know, there's so many interesting Warriors parallels to those early Warriors team. And I'll make another one, which is, I remember Cavs fans certainly would get worked up when people would cite that Steph Curry was the best finisher in the league because his rim field goal percentage was so good. And we're like, we got Kyrie Irving over here. He's unbelievable. But like, what I always would say to those people is, Steph is not an ungodly finisher at the rim. It's just that all his layups are so easy because everyone is so petrified of the shot, you know? And unless you take a lot, people just aren't going to lunge out at you. I mean, Darius was a guy where teams, not all the time, but consistently, were able to go under screens on him, because they just knew he wasn't going to fire. If you do that this year, he's going to fire. He's going to make it. And like, it's death. So he's inspiring more panic 25 feet from the basket, which is allowing his finishing to get even easier.
I love that. Nearly 4 pull-up threes a game for Darius Garland. I have to get the pace adjusted numbers so Carter doesn't yell at me on that
thank
front.
You. Thank you, sir.
But he is taking more pull-up threes. He's converting 39% of those. And I'm glad you noted what he's doing inside the arc, because that's probably been the most fun that I've had with Darius Garland this year. He's always kind of had the craft, and it's always fun when he's tossing the lobs, because you just don't know how he's setting up the hezzy and getting downhill. He puts you in jail. You don't know if it's going to be a slip, a fake pass into a scoop or whatever. The fact that, to Carter's point, he has that floater going to the degree that he has. He's shooting 52% on pull-up twos, which is nuts in and of itself. Pulled it up on Basketball Reference really quick. On shots between 3 and 10 feet, he's shooting 50% on those.
That's easy money.
Yeah. Like, that is easily a career high for him. He was at 40.6% last year. So having that kind of improvement, with the threat of some of those interior feeds, the chemistry that he has with Jared Allen, that he has with Evan Mobley, I think it's honestly him and Trae Young in terms of, you get drop coverage. I have no idea if this is a floater or a lob.
Yeah, yep.
Between those two. And Darius just has so much of that. And now that he is more aggressive, it makes the calculus that much harder for defenses. I have no idea if he's taking the shot now.
Yeah. And Dan Devine wrote a fantastic piece about Garland. He said one of the biggest differences this year is, when they were running plays in the past, a lot of the times what his read was going to be was kind of predetermined. Like, it was kind of built into the offense that way. And he said it took an adjustment to get used to the Kenny Atkinson offense. But now they're really just trusting him to make those decisions on the fly, to trust his vision. And, you know, the lob or floater kind of conundrum has always been something that he's had in his bag. But now I feel like he's spraying it out to three even more. And you know, the route tree is much more complicated, and it's a lot harder to figure out exactly what's going to happen on any given possession.
I love it. I guess to flip it to the other end of the court, I'll actually pose it as a question to the both of you. I'll start with you, Justin. How have you felt about the Darius Garland defense experience this year?
I think it's been better. Like, I think he's having his best kind of individual season defensively. Maybe some of that is, you know, he's been more disruptive, getting steals, blocks. He's broken up some plays in transition. There has been some noise when it comes to kind of the opponent 3-point shooting, particularly in those Garland Allen minutes. Those numbers are starting to normalize, but I think that is hurting some of those, you know, defensive EPM numbers, because that is so reliant on kind of that on-off data. But I do feel that his individual defense has been really good. And I think one of the things I've really enjoyed is we've seen this in spurts in the past. He's wanted to take on those defensive assignments. He's wanted to defend opposing point guards, but now I feel like they're trusting him more and more, where they're like, you know what? We have good backline defenders. We have guys that are able to stay with their man. Let's just trust Darius to fight through screens. Let's trust him to defend his man. If he gets switched onto a bigger wing, we will trust him to kind of stand his own. And you know, guys are going to be able to shoot over him to some extent, but he's going to at least make them work. He's going to be disruptive, and we're not going to yield open shots in an attempt to hide him defensively. We're not going to be throwing, you know, 2-3 defenders anytime a mismatch comes on him, because we trust that shooting over, you know, a 6-1 Darius Garland is still going to be a worse look, particularly if it's a mid-range shot, than a swing pass to an open shooter.
Yeah, I think ultimately there's no harder shell defense in the league to score against that isn't in rotation than the Cavs. That's what I'll say. You might be able to argue the Thunder are there, but you know, the Thunder, I think they make the most of their hay and the chaos that they create, you know, whereas I think the Cavs, if they're just sitting back and you haven't messed them up, you're just going to be dependent on jumper variance in the end. Like, you don't have a road to clean looks. Like, I mean, you've watched these Nuggets and Warriors games, how many layups are just getting biffed? Even the ones that are semi-open, because they're just so freaked out by all the length at the second level of the defense. So I think Kenny has really made a smart gamble in just saying, hey, we're not going to bust our defensive philosophy to hide you. He even said that after, I think, the second Boston game, where he was like, I went up to Darius and like, we can't hide you anymore. We're not going to do that. It's not, the juice is not worth the squeeze to make you look better, or to make, you know, because like you, like there will be plays playing this way where Darius gets cooked or overpowered. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, and even after a win against the Boston Celtics where Jason Tatum did not do a nice job in isolation, you still had people online going, Darius is getting buried by Tatum, getting buried, because there are possessions where it looks really ugly. But I think Kenny really just kind of said like, hey, we can't afford to do that. It's, you know, you might have to take a pride hit on a few possessions and get cooked, because on balance, the shell of our defense and the amount that we can protect you when you get isolated on, even against bigger, stronger, talented scorers, we're comfortable with that. There are a lot of plays where Tatum was able to turn the corner on Darius, but he made it just hard enough that Mobley was there, Dean Wade was there, Jared Allen was there. And I think that kind of stuff is just a total game changer for how the defense functions. And Darius has to hold up just well enough to make it worth it. But also, like, the other thing is you just get teams to break their plan, you know? Like, mm-hmm. you can, like, it's chum in the water to some extent to see a small, you know, not super bursty, not super long guard out there on your best win. So like I think between Darius just holding up better than you would expect and all the support structure that you have for him on the back line, I just think it's been a really symbiotic relationship between his effort level, his just getting stronger as he gets a little bit older, and the defense not compromising itself to accommodate him.
I think to that point, it reminds me of something that Steve has said about the Cavs, but just overall, like as a defense, if you're switching out different players, like we just need you to hold up enough to where teams are like, okay, we got to do something mm-hmm. else. You don't need Darius Garland to be a lockdown defender. Hey, just get stops on two of these next three possessions. Yep. And if we do that, then maybe they try to attack elsewhere and then you're okay. And to your point, Garter, having that kind of shell, when you just have Evan Mobley and Jared Allen, and if Dean Wade's on the floor as well, that's so much size that you can use to shrink the floor without having to oversell in a best case scenario. And even Donovan Mitchell, you know, technically a smaller guard, but the wingspan there, if you have him at the nail, if he's engaged, he's
really good.
He can also just be
closing back out. That's one of his best strengths as a defender, is just he can chop the feet, use the length, and like not get himself off balance when he does have to take two steps into the paint. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, you're good. That complements the point. Like you can just, you don't have to super hide Darius Garland, but you still have the shell in place to where you can't attack him as easily anyway. And I think to your point about Kenny Atkinson, trust him a little bit more. Like I think the added strength helps. They have switched him so much more this year. You see that anecdotally, like in the Boston game that you referenced, but even pulling up the numbers on Second Spectrum, when he's the screener defender last year, he was switching about 19% of the time. It was mostly going to be show and recover, and let's see how we deal with it after that. He's switching nearly 52% of those picks now.
Yeah, and I will say the soft switching has been one of my very few gripes when it comes to the Cavs defense. Like, I feel, particularly in that second Boston game, I thought that they were giving up the switch for Garland onto Tatum a little too freely. And when you look at kind of the late game possessions of that one, they fought through it a little bit more. Like, Isaac Okoro was fighting through the screens. He's such a good screen navigator. They were trusting him to do that. And I just, if you're eventually going to get that Tatum onto Garland switch, I prefer that occurring after they've had to rescreen two or three times and make him work a little bit more, because then it's later in the shot clock. He's used up more energy, and I think that gives Garland more of a fighting chance. But he has done a really good job of holding up. And, you know, he's got a good wingspan too, right? Like, I think he's got a 6'4", 6'5 wingspan. So his standing reach is at least solid. He's done a good job the last few years. And I kind of feel like in general, he's gone into that Steph Curry zone where, okay, his defensive positioning is going to be solid. He's going to give up size and strength to certain players, but we can trust the defensive integrity. And one of my biggest gripes when it comes to kind of the Cavs conversation is so many times people are like, they got to get a big wing defender. Like, they just got to get a big wing defender. That this is something they need to add, which, don't get me wrong, like, I would love to add a Cam Johnson. That. Yeah, I would love to add that. But because that has been such a large part of the conversation of what this team needs to do to get over the top, I feel like people have ignored the fact that the defense has never been an issue. It has never been an issue in the regular season. It's never been an issue in the playoffs. It hasn't been an issue in the playoffs when they have two guards on the court. In fact, when they were missing Jared Allen and they were playing with Garland, Mitchell, Strus, and Mobley against Boston in the playoffs, so, you know, two guards, you don't have your backline help defender there in Jared Allen, they had a good defensive rating and they outscored Boston in those minutes for the series. Like, the biggest problem has been that the offense hasn't translated to the playoffs. I think that has been the thing Carter and I have been monitoring, how the Cavs perform against the best defenses in the league, how they do in those matchups. Do those defenses get them to change what they're doing offensively? How does Evan Mobley factor in against that? Because what I ultimately think is, if you are going to have an offense that's primarily built around two smaller guards, you need to have front court playmaking to beat the best defenses in the league in the playoffs. That's the only way that it's worked in the past, right? Like, when you think of teams that have had two smaller players and won a championship, they usually have that, right? Like, Toronto had Marc Gasol that they could rely on when they're playing Kyle Lowry and Fred VanVleet out there at 5'11". You know, people are going to roll their eyes at this one, but, like, you think of the Miami Heat with, like, Mario Chalmers and Wade was only 6'4", right? Like, he's only an inch taller than Mitchell. Both of them have long wingspans, but they always had, you know, you could run some offense through Shaq. You could run some offense through LeBron, right? Like, they had just those. They had front court playmakers that you could help alleviate some of the pressure when you trap the guards, right? So I think that has always been the most important thing. And I think that has been why so much of the conversation has centered around Evan Mobley's ability to generate offense, to be a hub, to be, you know, 7 foot Bam Adebayo.
I wish we had more of 6'9" Bam Adebayo this year on offense, but that's a different podcast for another day. But to your point about what Cleveland does against the best teams and the best defenses, only a 5-game sample on Clean the Glass for Cleveland versus top 10 defenses, a 119.6 offensive rating, which is tops in the league. I think that's pretty darn good. That's a good signal for them. Back to the Garland thing though, like, him switching more, and I think it's 0.89 points per possession on those trips when Garland switches. I don't know how sustainable that number is, because that is, like, league best stuff. But to the overall point, it doesn't have to be that. Like, it just has to hover around.
Hold on. Can I challenge that actually a little bit? So, like, sure. The one thing I'll say is, so, like, I think the league best stuff, it wouldn't be reflective of Darius doing such a good job as much as it is reflective of your choices are still try to beat Darius and then meet Jarrett or Evan at the rim, or take a mid-range jumper. And even the best mid-range jumper shooters in the league they're going to be around 0.9 to 1 points per possession, you know? Like, I just don't think that I think somewhere in that range is actually pretty reasonable. But just because of the fact of all the stuff around Darius. I actually don't think Darius his personal effort dictates that outcome as much as just, well, you're still going to go against a set Cavs defense, and that sucks. That sucks to go against.
That number's not going to look as good if you like swap them for Haliburton on the Pacers, right? Like if the infrastructure around him wasn't as good defensively.
Right. It's very much an all-encompassing number, to your point. But the fact that that is better than last year does signify like Darius has gotten better. DeShale has been better and healthier, which is probably the bigger picture point on that front. But it's been really good stuff for Darius Garland. I've really enjoyed him. We didn't get to talk about Clutch Player of the Year on the last pod. We just ran out of time. Darius Garland was going to be like my dark horse candidate for it as you get into some of the numbers that he had, like where he is in clutch points. I think when I last checked, he was shooting like 70% from the field or something ridiculous. Led the NBA in clutch plus minus. We talked about the pick and roll play a little bit earlier. He does have the highest pick and roll points per possession number in the league per second spectrum. In clutch time, it's 1.39 points per possession. Obviously, a smaller sample, but it is just absurd.
For what it's worth, an even smaller sample than other small samples, because the Cavs have only played 39 minutes in the clutch this year because they're killing everyone.
Yes. And so when they do get there, the fact that you can lean on Darius to that degree, you still have the shot making and playmaking, but mostly the shot making of Donovan Mitchell. And good gracious, I mean, Evan Mobley's going to finish everything. Jared Allen's going to finish everything. And on the other end, as we've been talking about, you have to worry about that defensive shell of the Cleveland Cavaliers. Actually, pivoting to Evan Mobley really quickly. I'll start with you, Carter. What has been the most impressive part of his season to you?
Yes. Yes, it all has been very impressive, Nikitas. I don't know, man. So, you know, it's one of those interesting things where, you know, obviously we're trying to, as we go into the season, Justin and I are trying to like, we're trying to really balance, have a nuanced, interesting discussion about Evan. And something that's kind of griped both of us out when people talk about Evan's, you know, a lot of people have decided certain things about Evan, that he can't function as a four, that the scoring won't be ever where it needs to be, that the handle won't ever be where it needs to be. And I do think he has, in a lot of ways, been the victim of how high his bar was as a rookie. You know, most rookies, even the really talented ones, come into the league and suck and don't help winning. So they just have a lot more room to go on the way to being as good as Evan is right now. So, you know, their leaps are always going to look a lot more pronounced. And I think Evan has been, you know, it's been a lot of iterative growth year over year over year, you know? And if you look at his basketball reference page, it really does look like that. For the most part, it's just like everything's 10% better every year. And, you know, that's not necessarily sexy up until this year. It got sexy this year. And, you know, a big thing that Justin and I have spent a lot of time talking about, because everyone with the two bigs is like, well, Evan's got to learn how to shoot. He's got to be a good shooter or it doesn't work. And something that I talked about this summer was like, well, no one says that the Pelicans need to shoot a stretch five because Zion can't shoot. And it's because Zion's playmaking was so strong. You know, if you sink, you know, 10 feet off Zion, he's just going to bowl you over into the basket and get an easy bucket or draw a foul or miss and get an offensive board, whatever it is, you know. And, you know, rip Zion. Hopefully we see him again sometime. But you know, so I've always felt like the playmaking and the off the bounce stuff for Evan has mattered more than the jumper. And I think Justin has generally agreed. But then Evan hit us with the why not both meme, you know, where the playmaking's better than it's ever been and the jumper's better than it's ever been. It's like everything just kind of clicked into place all in one fell swoop. Like, he's taken more threes than he took last year already. He's made more threes than he took last year already. You know, he's 43% on three attempts per 36. Like, that is probably as much volume as I need from him as a shooter. And then the ball handling game is kind of has to be my answer, I guess, because, I mean, he's running pick and rolls. He's initiating offense. He's been basically told to, he has to run every fast break if he gets the board, you know? And I actually asked, we had Dean Wade on for an interview, and I kind of asked him about that pace and kind of mechanically how they've done it. And he actually threw a lot of credit at Darius and Donovan for being willing to just run the floor the second Evan gets the board. They aren't running to him to try to get the ball so they get to initiate. Like, everyone's pretty much agreed Evan gets to run the offense if he gets the board. And I think I think that kind of, those kind of built in, they're kind of almost built in playmaking reps when you do that. You know, he just gets to do it a lot because he gets a lot of defensive rebounds. So I think the fact that he's able to run pick and roll, the fact that he's mashing switches the way he is in the post, the way that he's able to you know, run inverted pick and rolls with Sam Merrill and now Max Strus, like, it just, everything feels a lot more dynamic with his off the dribble game. The 3-point stuff almost feels like a cherry on top.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, I don't think it ever matters how well he shoots from three. Like, even if he, you know, let's say theoretically he kept up this 43% on, like, and even up the attempts per 36 to like four a game, I think teams are still going to play him. Defenders are still going to play him in that kind of 4 to 6 feet off him range, right? Because you have to, you know, you have to be up there. You don't want to overcommit because he is so long that he's going to be able to get by you with the stride, and then he's attacking the basket with advantage and ahead of steam. So, you know, his release isn't the quickest too. So if I can get a late contest out there, that's going to make a bit of a difference. But I still think there's a difference between kind of playing 4 to 6 feet off him versus 6 feet plus off of him. And I think one of the things that, you know, to Carter's point of the playmaking being important, you look at how well spaced those Warriors teams were over the years. And a lot of the times they had 2-3 guys that you didn't respect from three. Like, they played with a traditional big a lot. They had Andre Iguodala out there. They had Draymond Green. They had Sean Livingston. They had Leandro Barbosa, right? Like, they had a lot of guys that you didn't really worry about from three, but you had to factor them in because the spacing was so good. Where they were positioned on the court was so well thought out. They were all playmakers and the ball had momentum. And I think you even see when the Cavs are playing with Alan Mobley out there, sometimes it is five out. Like, everyone's standing outside the 3-point line and, you know, you still kind of have to factor, you still have to kind of play up on those guys. You still have to factor in what Jared Allen's doing as a screener there, because if you're sagging off, okay, he's going to set a very good screen and a shooter is going to get an open shot, or he's going to attack with a head of steam and, you know, both of the bigs are able to Euro step around a defender and then still finish a dunk, right? Like, they're so athletic. They're such good secondary playmakers playing off of some very good playmakers in the guards that I just think it has changed the calculus of what this team is able to do offensively. And I think it is an example of what spacing actually is in the NBA. You know, so often it's, okay, we think of spacing as what the Harden Rockets did, when really you have to think back to, you know, the Warriors, the Spurs, when they were playing their best basketball. I think this is a team that generates their offense in a very similar way, and that's what makes them so hard to account for, no matter what those combinations are.
Yeah, I think to that point, like, the way that they have moved both of the bigs around has been intriguing to me. Like, we've talked a little bit about Evan Mobley being used as a hub. Jared Allen can still be used as a hub. Like, it's been slightly more dunker spot usage with the bigs. Also, they'll sprinkle in the coral or guard in the dunker spot as well. They just do a really good job of putting strain on defenses in a multitude of ways and just moving guys around the chessboard. And it's hard to get a beat on them. And, like, through the context of Evan Mobley, the fact that you can just put him in the dunker, if he's, especially if he's the lone big out there and he's just a lob threat for you, or he's a really good relocator, he'll just get to the middle of the floor. And then from there, push shot, short jumper, or I can now take a dribble and now I'm at the rim again. What do you do? As a defense,
his functional strength has also just gotten a lot better. I think this is an old stat. I don't know what the number is right now, but at one point he had a 33% and one conversion rate, where, you know, a third of the time he's getting fouled, he's also scoring, you know. And I think
ethical hoops.
Oh, such ethical hoops, Nikias. We don't bait here in Cleveland. We don't grift here in Cleveland. But no, I think, you know, there's a lot of what I felt he's needed to do is just, you know, literally grow into his body a little bit. He's not like some big bulky dude. He hasn't put on like 40 pounds of mass. You know, he's just a grown up now. You know, you forget how young he was. And you know, there's a difference between a teenager strength and a grown man strength who's had a couple years in an NBA weight room. And like, you're really starting to see that even on the dunker spot as a four, where you can have Jarrett be the guy on the dive, because Evan can bury a lot of these smaller power forwards in ways he couldn't in years past. You know, that like, it's really meaningful that he can duck in on a strong four, like some of these stockier fours, and then just, you know, take a bump, not be knocked back 6 feet by that bump or off balance and having to do a fadeaway, but instead go straight up using his floater and lap. And he's able to high point a lot of these field goal attempts where his jump is very, very fast. So if he's on balance when he goes up and he's 5 feet from the rim, it's basically a layup. It's just a lot easier for him than any other power forward. So I feel like that strength is the sneaky thing about his game. It unlocks everything. You know, when he posterized Andre Drummond and Caleb Martin in Philly a couple games ago, and you know, Martin's up in his chest off the dribble and he's bumping him and he's hitting him and he's staying on balance as he crosses over and then attacks the lane. And like, an Evan Mobley who isn't able to be knocked off a center of gravity just gets really hard to deal with.
It's terrifying. Like, I think a lot of the strength conversations for Evan, at least for me, it was mostly through the lens of how well is he going to hold up at the five when he has those in those single big lineups. When the box outs comes, can he swim past those, get boards, end possessions for you, et cetera? That stuff has obviously gotten better. But to your point, him being able to absorb blows better on drives, like, that was one of the things that popped for me the most earlier in the year when we talked Cavs on the pod. It's like, hey, he is grabbing and going more. He is getting this random inverted screens for him. He can get downhill. But some of these self-created looks to where he faces up, takes a dribble, he's delivering the blow first and foremost, which is fun for me. And then he's absorbing that contact and getting to a look that he wants to get into. Like, him being able to do that consistently is such a big deal for him now and moving forward. And to your and one stat, unfortunately, it is now down to only 29.7% of the time.
Cut it from the pod, Nikias.
Yeah.
he stinks now. He just can't convert anymore. But no, Evan Mobley has been incredible. I guess the other question I would ask on the Mobley front, defensively, I think for Cleveland overall, it's just been a lot more switching. Have you felt his impact grow defensively this year?
Yeah, I think this is the first year where he is truly anchoring the defense. I think in the past, there was an argument that Allen was having, you know, as much or more impact on the defensive end, particularly when you look at the lineup data. But I think, you know, the easiest way to look at this is, all right, how does it look when it's just Mobley out there on the court? And when it's just Mobley out there at the five, they have a 101.9 defensive rating in over 900 possessions. It's 112 with the two bigs together. As I said, those Allen only minutes have been hit with some 3-point shooting variance. So it's a 116.4 defensive rating in those minutes. But, you know, Mobley has really been able to anchor the defense in, you know, I think the best rate of his career. Like, I think he is consistently making a dramatic difference out there on the defensive end. I think he's holding up better against larger players. And, you know, when I talked about, you know, the individual kind of combinations that they have, that Mitchell and Mobley line up, they're winning on the defensive end. Like, the offense hasn't been great in those minutes. I expect the offense to get better and the defense to get a little bit worse. But that lineup has a 114.9 offensive rating, but a 99.2 defensive rating, right? Like, all right, so they're going to exhaust you with defense, and then you have Garland and Allen coming in with their 131 offensive rating, right? Like, you're just getting punched in two very different ways. And, like, same thing with that Allen and Garland lineup. Like, I understand it's over 700 possessions at this point, but I do expect that offense to come down and I expect that defense to improve. Like, I think we're going to find a happy medium here at some point. But I really do think, you know, as I said before, Mitchell is always going to be the lead play finisher on this team. I think even if you get to the point that we've been talking about, which is can Evan Mobley be the most impactful player on this team? I still think that means, you know, maybe he's the second or third leading scorer on the team. Mitchell's always going to be that leading scorer, and Garland is always going to be the leading playmaker and, you know, the guy that's probably accountable for the most points on a given night when you look at his own individual points and assists. But it's from an impact standpoint with Mobley. I think, you know, we've seen Rudy Gobert go out there and, you know, win Defensive Player of the Year and make All-Star and All-NBA with, you know, 15 and 12. But you got Evan Mobley right now, who is per 36, averaging 22 points per game, 10 assists, one of the best defensive players in the league.
And 10 rebounds.
To be 10 rebounds. Did I say 10 assists?
Yes, you did.
That would be sweet. I would love that.
Shoot, he might
one day. And the funny thing is, his assists are actually down this year, but he is very clearly involved more in the offense than he has been in the past. So I think that's one of those things where, you know, you have to watch on a nightly basis. You have to see how often him initiating the offense is leading to a pass that's leading to the pass that gets the assist, right? He has just been a much, much more dynamic player. And I would say where he's at right now is where I hoped he would get by mid-April. Like, yeah. I thought it was going to take a little bit more time. What we've seen from him the last few years, even with, you know, the missing time with injury, when he came back from that injury, he started shooting better. He had very clearly worked on some stuff in his game. He always gets better from January on. And what I'm really curious to see is, okay, so he started where we kind of were hoping he would get to by the playoffs. Where can he get to by now? Because I think no matter what the Cavs do, the Boston Celtics are going to be favored in a series. And, you know, if you play that series 100 times, maybe Boston wins, you know, if we're being feeling ourselves right now, maybe Boston wins 70 times. Well, can Evan Mobley grow enough where we get that number down to like 65, 60? Because at the end of the day, I think the Cavs are good enough to compete for a championship. I think they're good enough to win for a championship. And what it's really going to come down to is who executes better in that 7-game series. Are you able to, you know, increase your margin for error? Are you able to iron out some of the things that you need to do in order to pull off that upset? You know, so often we just talk about, you know, the results as something that, okay, we've solved the equation. This is what it would always be when, you know, I think especially in this era of parity, it's going to come down to matchups. It's going to come down to who's playing better at a given time. And I think sometimes the discussion around these teams and, you know, who's better needs to improve, because it really, I think, does come down to, you know, who is executing at the right times, who is able to take advantage of those matchups and, you know, just really appreciating the different styles that these teams play with that make those questions so interesting.
So to answer your question, we think Evan's been a lot better on defense this year.
Yeah, he's been good.
Yes. And like, I guess it I should have framed it a little bit.
My turn for a very long-winded answer, Carter. Look, I've edited our podcast. I see how long you go.
Ooh, a little behind the scenes smoke. We like it. But I should have framed it in a different way. Just more, how have you seen the defensive impact evolve in light of more to switching, more than is he impacting?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, I don't,
he's been tremendous.
Take that, Carter.
Honestly, I think he's as good as he's ever been as a switcher. You know, I don't think he's taken it up another notch. You know, I think he's been an elite switch defender from Jump Street. You know, and I think a lot of it, you know, last year they just couldn't do it as much, in fairness to, you know, JB, where Evan only played 50 games last year, you know, and a lot of the games where Evan was there, Jarrett, you know, had a few stretches where he was out. And like, so, and you know, it gets a lot harder to switch when it's just the one guy, because then you've got, you know, you've got Niang protecting, and also Dean missed quite a bit of time last year, and he's kind of your third best rim protector, you know, and then it's a pretty steep drop off from there. So I think ultimately a lot of that, you know, clearly it's part of Kenny's philosophy to switch a little bit more aggressively. I feel like I've seen Evan's growth actually guarding those big bulky post up bigs. You know, Jokic, it's not just food for the Jokic's of the world when he's guarding them. They missed both Embiid's games so far because they were on the wrong end of back-to-backs. So they have not played an Embiid just yet. But yeah, I just don't think he's bullyable in the same way he was.
Mm-hmm.
I got you. I think circling to the other two all-stars on the roster, I think Darius Garland, Evan Mobley, to different degrees, have kind of shaped this season. They've been the narrative of the season. I guess for a non-Cavs watcher, like, how would you contextualize what you've seen from Donovan Mitchell and Jared Allen this year?
I guess the first word that jumps out is maturity. Like, I think with Donovan in particular, there is an understanding that, okay, you know, last year he had to do a lot of the heavy lifting.
He played a lot of point guard,
particularly in the playoffs, right? Like, Darius wasn't himself physically, so they were playing him off ball. I think Donovan looked at the last couple of years and said, in order for us to get where we need to get to, I need to take a little bit of a step back. I need to play off ball more. I need to improve how I play off ball. I need to be more efficient with my possessions.
Can I interrupt real quick? And because you had a great stat, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but wasn't it the two best offensive outputs for the Cavs in the playoffs last year were games Donovan sat?
Yes. Yeah. Against Boston. The game four where the Cavs almost won without Allen and Mitchell. And I think even the game that they were eliminated, right? Like, and I think he understood that in order for this team to reach its best potential, Garland needed to be the one initiating the offense and Mobley needed to be a big part of the offense as well. And I think that you just really see his maturity and leadership throughout the season. I thought there was times where it seemed early in the year he had the biggest adjustment where, you know, he hadn't touched the ball in a while and he got the ball and it was like, you know what, this is a Donovan scoring possession. And, you know, there was a lot of dribbling and he would, you know, kind of force shots in those spots. But even when he has those moments, it's like he goes to the bench, he recognizes it, he reflects, and he comes out and he makes those adjustments in game. I even felt that against the Lakers. I thought, you know, he was kind of throwing up some garbage in the first half. And then second half, he comes out and boom, like the decision-making's better. He's taking better shots. He's hitting those shots. Like, we've seen that a few times this year. And I feel like the Mitchell hero ball possessions are becoming less and less frequent. And it's just, I think it's really, really to his credit, the amount that he's sacrificed this year and the way that he's adapted his game. Then Jaren Allen's just always willing to make the sacrifice. Like, some nights he's only going to get 4 or 5 shots and he is still going to work just as hard on the glass. He's still going to, you know, work to be a physical presence against Nikola Jokic. Like, there are so many times and so many matchups against the best teams in the league where I just wouldn't feel as good about the Cavs' chances if they had to put Evan Mobley on, you know, the 5 full time. Like, I feel way better against Denver because we're able to put Jared Allen out there against Jokic. He does as good of a job on him as anybody. He does a very good job on Joel Embiid. He does a good job in a lot of these matchups. And, you know, those guys are still going to get their numbers, but he's going to make them work and he's going to make it easier for Evan Mobley to do what he does on both ends. So I just think both of those guys, as kind of the veterans among the core, have really shown a lot of maturity and selflessness. And I don't think that this ecosystem works unless both of those guys have that mentality.
Yeah, to echo Justin's point, I think maturity is absolutely the right word, especially for Donovan. I think he's been such a freaking grown-up through this year, you know? Like, he is one of the older dudes on the team, and, like, to some extent that helps to be a veteran, but it also is hard when you have to, when you've played one way your whole career, and even into last year you played one very, like, aggressive way, and it was working quite well for you. You know, he was very, very good in that playoffs. But to have the kind of the maturity to understand, like, hey, I this isn't sustainable. You know, I'm scoring 50 and we're cracking 101, like, in the game. Like, it's just not, you know, like, the juice is not worth the squeeze. And we have to change the way we're doing things. In his preseason media availability, Kenny talked a lot about how he wanted less grenades for Donovan. You know, there were a lot of possessions for Donovan, would just kind of have to uncork one because everything else had broken down. That comes to pace, which Donovan is really committed to playing with. Because as much as we want to give Kenny credit for the pace, you know, it's not like we didn't see JB Bickerstaff clapping on the sideline, like, go, go, go!
Screaming.
Last year, every possession, you know? Like, both Donovan and Darius are guys who kind of like to walk the ball up the court and survey and probe and, you know, pass up the first good shot and to see if you can find a great one. And, you know, so the fact that he bought into the pace, And then he's also really bought in as an off-ball player. Another thing Kenny really talked about wanting to push for Donovan was more catch and shoot threes. He's up to 10.7 three-point attempts per 36. He's shooting 41.5% on those threes. And I think one of the reasons he is looking at the best three-point percentage of his career by a country mile is because he's just taking easier ones. Like, yeah, he's taking pull-ups mm-hmm. and he's making them at a high rate. I'm not saying that isn't helping, that his pull-up game is maybe better than it's ever been. But also, he's trailing a lot more and taking trailing transition threes. He's running to the corners and getting easy corner catch-and-shoot threes. Like, I just don't... obviously, I don't have all the stats right in front of me, but I don't remember as many easy threes for Donovan as he's gotten this year.
And I think, to your point, like, him having to trust in the ecosystem at large... I think part of what helps that pull-up number look the way it is, it's like he doesn't have to hunt them all the time.
Yeah.
He's already in a rhythm because he's gotten a couple of easy ones. And now I can flow into this pull-up if you mess up a switch or you're going into deep drop when we're setting this 45-foot high screen with Jared Allen as he crosses half court. And now I can just kind of flow into this because I'm already feeling it. Like, it's such a rhythm thing with him. And I think Donovan, even going back to like the Utah day, I feel like he's always kind of flashed this ability to operate on and off the ball. Mm-hmm. He's been put in situations to where, okay, I just got to do this. And he's been really good at it. So it's been fun for me after that initial, like, first couple of weeks as he was trying to feel things out. It's been fun for me just watching him flow off the ball more. Like, the transition point you mentioned was a really strong one. Just him being used as a screener more this year has been, that's something that you've alerted me to. And that's been a lot of fun. You have just your general set pieces wearing horns. You're just one of the guys at the elbow and then kind of flow off. But even just some pure randomness,
I'll just screen for one of these guards. Every single time they run that horn set, where you have a big on one elbow and Donovan or Darius on the other doing a staggered screen or you know, a double screen that turns into the guard fades out and the big ends up screening for them. Like, they just get a clean look every time they run that set.
It was one of my favorite mm-hmm. things they did in 22-23, and it just felt like they got away from it last year. And, you know, Carter, you talked about the inability to play kind of the same switching defense last year. One thing I think to consider too is in that stretch where they played so well without Garland and Mobley, every single person that was playing big minutes in that stretch was dealing with something nagging. Like, LeVert's missing time with knee soreness, Wade's knee goes out, Mitchell couldn't play the second half of the year because, you know, his body was breaking down. So I think that was probably illuminating that, hey, like, we had to play so hard and we had to really, like, we were winning those minutes on defense primarily. I think that probably helped with the buy-in. But, you know, to your point about using Mitchell as a screener, like, there's just so much less predictability with the offense. Like, someone like Isaac Okoro, he's no longer just standing in the corner waiting for a three-point shot. Like, sometimes he's used as like a Bruce Brown screener, right? And
won a game for us passing out of the short roll.
Like, we've been screaming for that because he's always been a very good screener. And you know, I don't think he's got the best kind of handle to open up his playmaking vision. But usually if he's catching the ball off a cut, he makes some really smart reads. He sees the floor really well in those situations. So using him as a screener is a very natural way to do that. And, you know, the three-point shot has obviously been there. Nikias, this is, you know, it's 3 years now since 2022. I knew you were waiting for this. He shot 39.4% over the last 3 years from three. Like, the three-point shot is there. But I just think finding ways to get someone like that involved in the offense in a variety of different ways is going to help make his impact translate to the playoffs rather than, all right, like, I'm going to stand in the corner, and if I miss the 2-3 shots I get, that's my only real chance to impact the game. That's my only real chance to feel the ball. And I feel like when you put someone in that kind of a box, it makes things so much more difficult. And I think this gets to the Kenny Atkinson of it all, because I think Kenny Atkinson is a big part of getting that buy-in from Donovan Mitchell. As much as Mitchell may have felt that way, Kenny outlining a plan for, this is how we're going to use Mobley, this is how we're going to use you, this is how we're going to use Garland, and getting guys to understand what their role is has been one of the biggest things. Because, you know, even going back to what Carter said about Mobley getting the ball and Garland and Mitchell are running down the court, they're running down the court because they know that that is the intention of what they are trying to do offensively. One of my favorite possessions recently was Garland caught the ball on the wing, wide open three, but Caris LeVert was open under the basket. And Darius, you know, being a pass first player, passed it to LeVert. The pass is a little off. LeVert bobbled it. And you could just hear the mic by the court side. Darius is yelling, but he was wide open, because everyone on the bench was screaming at him that he should have hit the three. The ball ended up rotating to Garland. He popped the three, hit it, and like was kind of acknowledging to the bench, okay. Like, they are on each other because they know what their roles are supposed to be. Those roles are defined. And if someone is not doing what they're supposed to be doing, everybody is pulling in that same direction. They are pressuring Dean Wade to take more threes. They are, you know, trying to limit the number of dribbles that Caris LeVert is taking because he is so efficient in this role, right? Like, everybody understands what their assignments are and what the three most important things that they're supposed to be doing on the court is. And I think having that defined identity and also just having like this early season success, they're going to go into like a slump at some point. They are going to lose 3 out of 5 in all likelihood. Like, that's going to happen at some point this year because that just happens to every team. They have a North Star, though. Like, they have a proof of concept that this is what works. It's not like they came into this year, had some injuries to start, and all right, like, we just don't have proof of concept with what we're doing. They have that now, and I think laying this foundation through 30-plus games is really, really important.
Yeah,
it is, because
I asked Dean a little bit about kind of that kind of aggressiveness, that fact that you kind of are always, that they're kind of taking that shot. Everyone seems to know their role, but they're also empowered to like stretch. There's not this like, oh, I can't step 2 steps outside of the box that I've been placed in. And, you know, he did kind of acknowledge that in years past, they kind of were a team that let perfect be the enemy of good. And that everyone feels safe to try stuff and to go for, to take that open or sent, you know, when the ball bounces to them, even if they haven't made a couple, they know it's their job to shoot, that they have to go for it. You know, even a guy like Sam Merrill, who has been a sniper for this team last year, starts out the first 3 months of the season, he's the only guy who isn't shooting well. He was at like 32% from three. And like, it goes to kind of Kenny's clear foundational belief in the process and like in these guys. Like, Sam Merrill's minutes have not gone down, even though the threes haven't been falling. You know, he's generally been trusting, like, hey, if I keep getting Sam Merrill open looks, it's going to work out for me over the long run of the season. Yeah. So there is like a lot of, you know, Justin and I joked because we've been giving this team a lot of praise for being, you know, process over results oriented. And it's like, it's the most obvious thing to say that you are. Like, no one's going to go out and brag about being results over process. But like, I do think the Cavs, if you're really paying attention to what's going on, even when guys, you know, a guy like Ty Jerome, who came out of the season absolutely ballistic, he's cooled down quite a bit. Like, he's, you know, he's had some ugly misses. He's had some games where the rhythm isn't quite there, you know, 1-for-6, 1-for-7 game. He hasn't changed his play style one iota, you know. He hasn't turtled up as he's cooled off. And I think that stuff is really, really important, the fact that he's not getting punished for playing the same way he was playing when he was playing well, when the jumpers aren't falling at the same rate.
Like, I think zooming out, like, empowerment and refinement are probably the two words that I have for the Cavs mm-hmm. this year. And you two have outlined pretty much all of that beautifully, so I won't hang there too long. But like, even going to the touches per game thing that we've talked about privately, been a fun thing to track with the Cavs this year. Garland, 62 touches a game. Mitchell, 60. Evan Mobley, 58. Then you get the drop to Jared Allen at 38. But like, being able to spread the wealth to that degree, and to your point, you get the second unit guys in, like, this is what you do. We trust that you're going to do it. You have a cold spell. One, who cares? Because we might just win by 15 anyway. But for the larger...
Yeah, all this is easier when they're winning by 15. It's important to note that. If they were losing by 12 and Ty Jerome was having these games and they lost 3 in a row, then okay, maybe, you know, that's where it actually gets tested. So to your point, it is easier when you're winning by 15 anyway.
Yeah, but like, even to the broader point, like, it is important to kind of establish that foundation, like Justin said, and just to have these trust in these guys. Because once you get into the postseason, you would imagine Scout is going to get better, like going to be a little bit more physical. Like the fact that the Cavs can move you around to this degree and generate good looks, while at the back of the mind, you still have to think about the fact that Donovan Mitchell can't just have a volume game at some point. Yeah. Like, it's not like he can't just drop 50 on any given night.
He is the floor raiser. He really is. Like, you know, a lot of stars, like their big value is in how they can raise their ceiling. And Donovan's certainly part of that. He's been part of quite a few cavalanches so far this year. But I think where I've found myself like, oh yeah, that's really nice to have Donovan, are those games where it's like nothing, everyone's got bad dead legs, everyone's short in threes, and Donovan goes out and scores 9 out of 11 bucks.
He's
11 points or whatever.
He's the one that refuses to let a slump happen, right? Like, I think that has been one of the kind of most consistent things is, you know, I think Darius is really the ceiling raiser for the offense, but Mitchell is that guy that, you know, all right, things aren't working, I'm going to go out there and score. I don't think it's any coincidence that, like, their two losses to Atlanta happened to be when Donovan Mitchell's battling a bit of the flu bug and shot like 20% in those games, right? Like, I think that was definitely a big part of it. Maybe, you know, a noon game after Thanksgiving was part of one of those losses too.
Come on, NBA schedule makers. They made up for it with a New Year's Eve game in Los Angeles, yeah, and then 2 days off.
Yeah. That was very nice of them.
The players had to be thrilled when they saw that schedule.
That was very, very nice of them. I think, you know, you can always kind of look at location and timing, and sometimes that can give you some insight to the schedule. But I definitely agree. I think Mitchell has been that floor raiser for them. And, you know, how far they go is going to be determined by what we continue to see out of Darius Garland and Evan Mobley, right? Like, I don't think it's any coincidence that when you look 2 years ago, their only good offensive game, the only game that they looked like themselves against the Knicks, was when Garland was punishing the Knicks for dropping, right? Like, he was so aggressive in that game. He was hitting his shots, and that just opened up everything. And I think now that you're seeing a consistently empowered Garland and you're seeing a much, much, much better version of Evan Mobley, and all the role player adjustments that they made last year are now, you know, in place and contributing. That's a big part of it. Ty Jerome plays a big role. He went down in game two last year, right? And he went down as Garland went down, as Rubio was out and then eventually retired. And you're playing undrafted Craig Porter Jr. at point guard, right? Like, George Niang is in much better shape and he's contributing. Max Strus is starting to find his groove, right? Like, it's all the shooting that they brought in is now available to them while the core is doing what you know, were hoping they could do in a best case scenario. It's, you know, it's not often that everything breaks like this, and, you know, it's not guaranteed that it's going to continue. So I think that's why we're trying to enjoy the hell of it while it's happening.
A few general questions for you, as y'all have both provided insanely good insights. So I appreciate the both of you. On the shooting portion, as the Cavs have been the best three-point shooting team in the league, and when I looked at the tracking data this morning to do a little bit more prep, they're shooting 40% on pull-up threes as a team this year.
Sorry, everyone else isn't as good as us. I don't know.
Like, I guess just on a basic note, like, where does that even begin to normalize?
So here's what I'll say about the shooting writ large is I think there is a little bit of, I think there will be some eye rolls from the listeners as I kind of make this argument. But, you know, there's just this general refrain of the shooting is going to normalize, the shooting is going to normalize, the shooting is going to normalize. And that's true. But what I will say is, you know, like, guys like Karis are not going to keep shooting like 46%. Like, I understand that. But what I will say is that where the shots are coming from for this Cavs team is different than a team like Chicago or Boston, who are just shooting 50, you know, trying to get to 63 point attempts a game. You know, like, writ large, this team is generally funneling all their 3-point attempts to guys who are good at 3-point shots, or they are only being taken wide open by the guys who aren't, you know, like with the Celtics are not ever going to be like a 43% 3-point shooting team over any significant sample, because guys like Drew Holiday are taking like 8 a game, and Drew Holiday is not a 40% 3-point shooter for his career, you know. And yeah, Derek White was not a sniper for a long part of his career. Like, these guys are, they when, like, okay shooters are taking a lot of threes, which if you're going to get to 60 or, you know, 55 three-point attempts in a game, you have to funnel some of your three-point attempts to guys who are not absolute snipers. Like, mm-hmm. Darius Garland and Donovan Mitchell are, like, capital S snipers. Sam Merrill, sniper. George Niang, sniper. Max Strus, a very accurate three-point shooter based on the difficulty of the shots he takes. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there will be some normalization. They're not just going to be like a, you know, a 43% or whatever they are on the season forever. But, like, if you're expecting a huge drop-off, I just think you're not fundamentally looking at the diet, because they're not, you know, they're like a top 10 three-point attempt team. They're not a top one. They're not a top two, not a top three. So, like, yeah, their percentage had better be higher because they're letting better players shoot them and they're not taking as many.
Yeah, I think it's going to come back to earth. You look at how they're shooting when left wide open, they're shooting 46%. Like, that's not sustainable. That's going to come down. That's
not sustainable.
I think, you know, one of my favorite stats is Steph Curry on the shots for his career shoots 43%. There is no way that you can leave somebody open in a way that makes them shoot better than Steph Curry, right? Like, it's just not going to happen. But I think there is something to Carter's point that, you know, the way they generate those shots is very consistent. They've been able to weather the storm of guys going cold. Like, Garland's had his slumps from three. Mitchell's had his slumps from three. Sam Merrill's had slumps from three. But they have so many shooters. They're not overburdened in minutes. And they're getting good kind of consistent looks. And when one guy doesn't have it going, they are able to contribute in other ways. Like, Garland didn't shoot well against LA. That is a classic game of the difference between playing poorly and shooting poorly, because he didn't shoot well, but he generated a lot of open looks. He had generated a lot of open threes. And I think they have a lot of guys that can do stuff like that. I think one of the things that we're seeing with Boston this year, as opposed to last year, is they just took what they did really well and they ramped that up. Like, their isolation frequency is up. The number of three-point attempts they're taking is up by like 8 or 9. And I just think that's really tiring. Like, when you're just constantly hunting mismatches and playing isolation basketball, and all right, we got the switch we wanted. You got a smaller player on you. Three dribbles, step back, take a three. Like, you're going to see variance with that. I think I don't want to give them advice, but if I were to give them advice, like, going back to the diet of last year and having a little bit more balance and relying on the talented playmakers they have, I think that would, you know, make a big difference. Cleveland, you got guys that aren't overburdened in minutes. They have a offensive system that is consistently generating good looks. And that's why, you know, like, I look at a game like the first loss in Atlanta, not the weird kind of Thanksgiving one. The Cavs had, I think, 32 wide open threes. Like, they had 10 more wide open threes than the Hawks. They just didn't shoot well in that. And, like, you can kind of go, okay, like, that's a bad shooting game. That's shooting variance. But, you know, they're still generating good looks even in those games. They still had a chance to win that game because they still get a lot of shots at the rim and they still play really good defense. And, you know, we've seen them survive really good shooting luck, shooting variance games from the opponents, even on nights where they're not shooting well, because the foundation is just so solid. So I think it is going to come down. Those pull-up numbers are going to come down. Those wide-open three-point numbers are going to come down. But because they have so many shooters and the way that they're getting those shots, it makes things so easy for them. I think it's a little bit, you know, to call back to the Steph Curry rim finishing, the context that they're being put in is a context that's going to allow them to succeed.
Yeah, and I guess really what I'm saying, because you're 100% right, they're not going to keep shooting this well, especially on wide open shots. Like, it's just not practical. But I think there's no reason why this team shouldn't be in the top three in 3-point percentage every year. You know, like, last year, I was so befuddled that the shooting was just okay with all the personnel that was taking them. I mean, last year they were 15th in 3-point shooting percentage with all of these elite shooters on the floor. So I feel like, again, in many ways, I mean, this entire year is the year that we thought we were getting last year plus 30%. And, you know, I think the shooting is a bit, you know, rings true on that same motif.
I got you. It's transitioning to the second unit really quickly. As we talked a little bit about Caris LeVert, I think, Carter, you mentioned the shot profile refinement from him. Ty Jerome, his play this season. Sam Merrill, the three-point shooting he's provided. And the defense perking up a little bit for Sam Merrill as well. I feel like they just have, the Cavs do, a multitude of guys that fit alongside their core four. And obviously, once you get into staggering with just two and two, you can just fill those lineup spots with guys that play well off of those guys. Who is the ideal fifth for this Cavs team right now?
The ideal fifth, you said?
Yes.
Like in terms of starters, I think it's Max Strus. I think the movement shooting, the secondary playmaking, like that was one of his big leaps coming over from Miami to Cleveland. Like I thought what he did as a playmaker was really, really impressive. You know, I think some of it was he was a little overburdened at times. He played a lot more point guard than he should have had to, you know, coming from Miami where he was playing a lot of power forward to all of a sudden playing point guard for the Cleveland Cavaliers. You look at just the games that he played with a point guard, his 3-point shooting was up to 39%. So I think what Max is able to do is chemistry with Mobley, the connective playmaking. I think that it just is the best possible fit for the starting lineup. I also think it puts Dean Wade in kind of that ideal role because I think he is the perfect kind of four when you're staggering with those two bigs. I think sometimes you might close with Dean Wade because he gives you great size at 6'9", 6'10". And it's very fortunate for the Cavs that they have three good options when it comes to who can start at small forward in Wade, Okoro, and Strus. But I do think putting Wade in that proper context, allowing Okoro to play, you know, a little bit of that screening shooting guard role, I think that that is the best combination.
I think the boring answer is that all four could close any game, you know, depending on including Caris. Any game could be closed by any of them, depending on the context of the matchup, depending on the context of how, you know, what form they're in. Reality is, all four of those guys have big peaks and valleys in how well they play. You know, they are not all, you know, inherently reliable to do the things you need them to do. Like there will be some games where they don't have it. But with that said, I 100% agree with Justin. I actually don't think it's close. I think Max is just literally the most talented of the role players on the team. And what is nice about him is he is the most jack of all trades of the group. Like, okay, like Sam Merrill brings really good shooting, but he takes some stuff off the table in terms of size and playmaking. Max isn't as good of a shooter as Sam, but he can do all the other stuff. Caris can add a lot of playmaking, but you know, he's also runs really hot and cold. Sometimes the jumper isn't there. Sometimes the defense isn't there. Max can do all those things a little bit more reliably, even if the playmaking isn't as high as it is with Caris. Dean can guard big wings and hit catch and shoot threes, but his off the dribble juice just isn't quite there. And, you know, sometimes the three-pointer can go. So Max can do all that a little bit more reliably. You know, Okoro is the best defender, perimeter defender on the team by a mile, and brings toughness, but, you know, also can guard a little bit and be tough and have sharp elbows, Max. So, you know, he is the best role player of the team of adding stuff to the table without taking much off. Like, I never see Max on the floor and be like, oh, man, now we can't do X. Now we can't do Y, you know? And I think that jack-of-all-trades nature makes him the best fit on the roster at the three. But again, you know, if you're playing Milwaukee, I'd like to have Okoro out there. Garden Dame. If we're playing Boston, I might want Dean Wade because he does such a good job on Tatum and Brown. You know, there are going to be games where the guards are getting pressured and beaten up at the point of attack and even off ball, and you want one extra dribbling release valve and you want Caris. I don't think there's a lot of bad options. You could still argue there isn't an elite no-brainer option and maybe you might want that, but I think Max is the guy that takes the least off the table, and for role players, sometimes that's what you want.
He's also a lunatic on a team that sometimes needs
a lunatic is so helpful. Because this team is full of nice young men, and we've been joking, we've been calling him Mad Max, you know, because he's always just grumping, and, you know, I think he's the kind of guy who, like, adds that sharpness and that edge to them, you know? Mm-hmm. He's the guy who, like, a cutter is going through the lane, and he kind of just hits him with an elbow, and then when he gets called for the foul, cannot believe he's been called.
Cannot believe. There was a hilarious one.
The least reliable protester on the team.
Mitchell, I remember Mitchell recently had one where he saw the ball go off the other player and was like adamant, Kenny, challenge, challenge, challenge. Max, if he ever calls for a challenge, Kenny needs to learn you cannot trust that man. You cannot trust that man. He is the least reliable narrator you will ever see.
He was trying to guard. He tried to blow up a transition attempt in one of his first games back. And it was like a dunk, and he hit the guy below the elbow. I'm talking like bicep. And then he quit. He was like, come on. When he got called for the foul, I'm like, brother, you weren't even at forearm level.
He was used to playing for the Miami Heat and being allowed to mug people. I got to get my shots in.
I'm just going to, hey, listen, I'm going to let that one slide. That's fine. To your point. Like, what can I just say? Going back to like when Steve and I came on your pod, we were talking Cavs playoff preview. I think it was the Cavs Knicks series. Like to go from, oh, we hope someone can consistently fill that fifth player role, to here are four options that we feel good about on any given night is such a blessing for Cleveland.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still think like if I can put on my angst hat, like the fact that you don't know any of those four are going to give you great minutes, like, there is a little bit of that where, like, you know, generally Boston knows they can count on six or seven guys to be very good for them. And then there's a couple swing guys on a night-to-night basis. You know, I still think there's a little bit that with the Cavs, like my, like if you were to ask me, like, Carter, what's your biggest angst about this team? You know, I would, I'll still kind of go back to a lot of these guys turned into pumpkins last year. You know, you had three or four good options all regular season. And you couldn't really count on a lot of them, you know. Okoro's shot went away. Dean couldn't hit. Niang was, you know, had a pretty disastrous playoff. All these guys who were pretty good, like when the playoff dial got turned up, a lot of them, you know, I don't think the core four did. I think they all actually met the moment quite well, except Darius, who, you know, had a just, you know, what I would define as a lost season. But like, a lot of the role players weren't really quite there, you know? So it's when you have a lot of these B minus role players, it's nice to be able to ask one of them to get to a B plus, but like, what if none of them get to a B plus in a playoff series? And then now you have problems. So that's my one devil's advocate. The only little bit of Carter angst I'll sprinkle onto the pod full of abject positivity and love.
I worry about that a little less because I do think that, you know, Darius being right is the biggest difference maker. Like, I just think that, and also just the offensive system, the buy-in and all that, and, you know, the vibes, the health, everything. Like, I think that that's going to make things better. My biggest angst is that, you know, Dean Wade hasn't managed to stay healthy into the playoffs. And as much as they have a lot of depth at the 2-3, they don't have a lot of depth at the 4-3. Like, Dean Wade really is kind of that only third option that they have. And that freaks me out. Like, I would love to have someone that can play the 4-3, or maybe, you know, I don't think small ball five if you're talking playoffs, but someone that can fill that Dean Wade role that isn't Dean, just so you have a little bit of insurance, because George Niang plays the four, but he doesn't play that role. And that concerns me, because, you know, you can survive, you know, if Caris LeVert, Sam Merrill, Isaac Okoro, Max Strus, one of those guys are out, you can win those minutes by committee, right? Like, Ty Jerome can step up. Whichever ones of those guys are still there are able to play those 2-3 minutes. Look how well they did without Max Strus, you know, for the first half of this season. I think you can weather that storm. No Dean Wade doesn't give them a lot of options. Like, you're almost like, okay, if we really need a bigger body, do we call up JT Thor from the Charge? Like, you don't.
Yeah. Time is a flat circle, Nikias. And every year we go, we sure need Dean Wade a lot, don't we?
It is. He is incredibly important. And, you know, that's probably part of why, you know, when you're talking about who should start and whatnot, keeping him in that bench role, you know, managing those minutes, having him playing in that spot where he is most important, which is as the four, when you're staggering the bigs, that's probably part of my calculus there, along with just, you know, the lineup data, even though their record has been phenomenal with Dean Wade as a starter, the lineup data with Isaac Okoro at the three is dramatically better. The offensive numbers with Dean aren't great at small forward, right? Like, Caris LeVert is a better option, but he loves to come off the bench, so they're going to go with that. Max Strus, only 8 possessions, but hey, plus 54 net rating. That's obviously going to last.
Call it in, yeah. Baby. Lock it.
Let's count on that. But, you know, I do think, you know, that's probably my number one thing when I'm looking at the Cavs, when I'm looking at, you know, the trade deadline and possibly the buyout market. Like, part of me is wondering if movement being so dead and teams not being willing to give up first round picks is going to create a more interesting buyout market. But if I could get someone like a Larry Nance Jr., who unfortunately is hurt again, but in that archetype, so that you at least have some depth there, I'm going to feel a whole lot better, because I get worried about the non-Dean Wade version of this Cavs team.
See, this is the fun of doing a podcast with other podcasters, because my next literal question was going to be, is there anything that you are monitoring with this group outside of when we talked about the shooting, if it dips, et cetera? Anything that kind of concerns you a little bit?
I think it's the big man depth, honestly. You know, they have two centers that they are willing to play on the roster, and both of them start. One of them at power forward, one of them at center, and Jared and Evan. You know, they clearly do not want to play Tristan, and he is there for depth, leadership, etc., which is fine for, you know, where he is in his career. That's no dig at Tristan, but the second Evan or Jared goes down or hits foul trouble, you know, and like, and let's be clear, if either of them goes down for like a big injury, it, you know, it's probably game blouses, but if it's a quarter, if it's one playoff game, the fact that you have to go to Dean Wade at the five, which has worked very well, better than last year. It's worked very well in spurts. He's worked his ass off protecting the rim, switching out, boxing out, rebounding. He's rebounding the best rate he's ever rebounded in his career. But with all that said, it feels a little scary to me that that's the only, and if that doesn't work, then you're just going to lose those minutes, you know? So that's the one bit of roster that I look at that I go, oh man, it would be great if, you know, there was a buyout that could supplement that a little bit. And because they do have an open roster spot, you know, they certainly can add to this roster. Now, they're right over the tax threshold, so that is complicated, because probably the worst thing to be is like a million over the threshold, you know, where you're a tax paying team, but not getting all the benefits of having a team that costs so much, you know, that you're right there. So yeah, there's a lot of weird, you know, there's some, and that's, I guess my other angst is that they might decide they need to duck the tax this year. And the problem is, if you look up and down the roster, they're playing 10, 11 guys. So you can't, they don't have like a guy making $6 million a year, $7 million a year that's not in the rotation that they can just attach 2 seconds to dump to get under the tax. So it's like, are they willing to make their roster a little worse to get out of the tax? Are they willing to mess with the chemistry they have to get out of the tax? Like, these are weird, complicated questions that I'm just not sure what the team is going to decide to do, you know, as we're about a month out from the deadline.
Yeah, I think Caris LeVert is the biggest question there, because there is a lot of depth at the position. He has been playing great. He has had injury issues in the past, and you have to make a decision there. Like, maybe that is where you think, okay, can we potentially make a lateral move, move him four forward and move him 4-4-5 or a 4-3 and trust that it's not going to upset the chemistry, but, you know, maybe if we can make a lateral move on court for a player that's making less, and you know, we can thread that needle. Like, it sounds great in theory, but then you have to find a player.
That's a hard message to sell.
That's a hard message to sell too, right? Like, and it's okay, can we realistically thread that needle? Can we find a player that actually exists that fits that archetype that I'm describing, that makes, you know, the theoretical amount of money? Is that player available in the first place, right? Like, I think that's, you know, a name to monitor. But I share Carter's angst there. Like, I think if you can add a 4-5 or a 4-3, like that, some positional versatility there, but someone that can play in the front court, I think that would be ideal. We'll see if they can do that, but other than that, the only other thing I'm monitoring is just how Evan Mobley does in various matchups. Like, how does he do against a lot of size? How does he do against the Orlandos of the world? Teams that are going to muck things up and make it physical. And does that change how the Cavs approach things offensively? Because that's the whole, you know, that's the entire ball game is, can the Cavs implement their style of play and you know, maintain their identity regardless of what they're seeing other teams throw at them? Because I think the best teams in the league dictate the terms of engagement. I don't think the Cavs have consistently done that. That was one of my biggest gripes again in the Knicks series, was I thought they broke from their identity to overreact to what Jalen Brunson was doing when Jalen Brunson was not even scoring efficiently. Like, they were scrambling. They took themselves out of defensive rebounding position. And I felt like they should have just played that series straight up. If they can maintain their identity and maintain their style of play or find the counters when teams are doing those types of things, that to me is what I'm really keeping a close eye on the remainder of the season.
I want to flip it. What angst you, Nikias? Nervous about these boys?
Honestly, the shooting is probably like the biggest thing. Well, health is the biggest thing.
Sure.
But as far as the on-court stuff, it's like just seeing, I think the three-point shooting will dip. Where does it dip to? Mm-hmm. Do they go from a 40% three-point shooting team to like 38.5%? If it's that, then I just don't care. They're just still really good, and that's fine. If it's down to 37%, that's still solid, but then more variance is at play at that point. As far as other numbers I'm looking at, like, they don't crash the offensive glass.
Nope.
Very and much we want to get back in transition.
I just don't think they're any good at it.
So you're not getting the extra possessions with that. Yeah. And like,
you got a missed shot to do that too.
That's also true. But like, I also didn't expect them to kind of be like middle of the pack in terms of like defensive rebound rate as a team. And so like, my brain just goes to, okay, what's the matchup that may annoy them? Like, if it's them versus Orlando in the first round somehow. Like, is that the shots don't fall and Orlando is like +8 on the offensive glass? And this is how it gets kind of ugly. So like that kind of thing, something that I'm monitoring. And I guess the only
to the possession battle, one thing that really, really, really helps them this year, their assist to turnover ratio is very, very good. Mm. They are second in the league, or tied for first in the league with OKC. Those matchups are going to be wild next week, by the way.
I am very excited for those.
I might want it too much, Nikias. I won't lie to you. But but last year, they were a good assist to turnover team last year, but they've become great. And I do think that matters. You know, if you're not going to be an elite offensive rebounding team, if you're not going to be a crazy turnover forcing team like an OKC is, like, mm-hmm. you better take care of the ball and trust that you're going to just score more points per possession than your opponent.
I'm very curious if they're going to be able to take care of the ball well against OKC. That's going to be a real test.
Oh, I want it. Probably, I want it. Swing.
then the other thing, like, they're kind of low in terms of field goal percentage at the rim right now. Think Donovan, Darius, all below like their regular levels. Karis, think below his regular level as well. But that's something I expect to normalize, honestly, yeah. Especially with the way that they play. So really just shooting, rebounding as far as on-court stuff. And if they stay healthy, they're playing at a 70 win pace right now. Like, they're really freaking good. I don't have major questions beyond that. I think the proof of concept is pretty much there for the squad.
Yeah, I'm curious to see with the finishing at the rim too. Like, they are such a high driving team and such a low free throw rate team. And some of that I think is, you know, they make passes out of those situations. Garland's throwing lobs to the bigs and you're not going to draw free throws in those situations. But Mitchell's been very openly campaigning to get more calls, and that seems to be happening. And, you know, missed shots get erased if a whistle is blown. And I wonder if there's going to be a little bit of variance there.
There we go. All right. Well, last question I have for you, I told you before we started recording, I was going to toss this your way. While understanding, like, Cleveland is what it is because their core four is as good as they are and they complement each other, who would you ascribe like the team MVP vote to?
It's so hard. Like, you prepped us for this and I really don't know. Maybe I'll still say Donovan, even though I feel like Mobley is the anchor for the defense and Garland's the anchor for the offense, just because the leadership to make it all happen and still being as effective as he has been. I think you have to give credit to, you know, the best player on the team, the one that has taken that leadership role, the one that has bought into the extent that he has. You know, you can define value in a million different ways, but I think what Donovan has done has helped set the floor for what everybody else is doing.
I'm going to make a pick, but I'm going to start with saying that I really don't. I'm not going to be one of those people that gets super worked up if the Cavs don't have someone getting a lot of MVP votes, because I do think this is one of the more democratized team contributions that I've seen in a long time. Especially at the top three, but I mean, Jarrett's right there in terms of impact on a game to game basis. And so each of them assists in, you know, hiding the other's, you know, shortcomings so well that it's like, you don't want to pick one, because, like, you know, so much of what makes Donovan great this year is having Darius next to him. So much of what makes Evan great is having Donovan. So much, you know, because I think it, like, let's say you're like, because I know you're an Evan guy, and I think you might pick Evan. Well, I'll wait for you to have the floor here to do so. But let's say you are an Evan guy. His lack of, you know, he's not a volume scorer right now. He's, you know, he's about a 20 a game guy. That doesn't look so good if you don't have Donovan Mitchell scoring like 27 per 36. Like, yeah, maybe you have more gripes about that in that context, you know. Maybe you aren't as impressed with Donovan scoring if you don't have Darius diming dudes up the way he is. So I do think it's a really, I think it's pretty razor thin margins. With that said, I'm going to go Evan. I just think he has been the thing that's made this team go from really, really good 2 years ago. You know, I think it's no surprise that he only played 50 games, wasn't really himself for a healthy portion of the year, and they were just okay last year. And he has gotten better at all the things I needed him to get better at. And maybe he's getting, I'm giving him bonus points compared to Donovan because of that, because I've seen the most growth year to year from Evan. But I guess I'll go Evan, but I don't feel, I have no strength of conviction on this. I could be talked out of it easily.
No, that's fair. Like, I agree with both of you. Like, the beauty of this team is that all of them complement each other in this way. Like, it's very Spursian in that way. If I had to pick one, like, we were talking offline about this a couple of days ago, like, I probably also lean Evan just for what he means to the defense and how much of his development has unlocked his offense. Like, obviously the guards do a ton in leading the pace, but I don't think you get this kind of pace improvement without Evan being trusted to grab a rebound and not have to wait a couple seconds to pass the ball to someone.
Yep.
I can just go get a screen, attack early. If you do send help, now we're off to the races. And, you know, if you're saying Evan Mobley's like the third or fourth best offensive player in the lineup, if he's drawing two, you are screwed as a defense if he's the one that's drawing the extra defender. Because now you're worrying about a scrambling defense against Darius or Donovan, or if they drive, now it's just Jared Allen who just has the catch radius of Hall of Fame wide receiver. You're just in a tough spot. So I lean Evan, but again, I am with you. Like, the answer is just yes for this group.
Yeah.
Fun fact, Jared Allen leads the team in win shares by like a healthy margin.
Like, there you go.
They're just good everywhere, man.
And I will just say, and this is a message to our good friend Steve, part of why I think Darius absolutely should be an all-star this year is, you know, when you look at the per 36 production, he is as productive and more efficient than, you know, just about any guard in the NBA. Like, I think the three locks that I would have would be Mitchell, Brunson, and Garland. I think you can put Darius's numbers per 36 up there with anybody else. He's scoring just as much as Maxey in those minutes. I don't think he should be punished for playing fewer minutes because they blow teams out. And, you know,
and I think it's messed up that Steve would punish him like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it is messed up. And what I'll say is this, you know, based off last year, the Indiana Pacers had the best offense in NBA history. And I thought Tyrese Haliburton, even though his play dropped off after a couple months, the fact that he was the focal point of the best offense to that point in history, he got rewarded with all NBA, all-star Olympic spot. When you look at the on-off impact, the Pacers were 0.6 points better with Haliburton on the court versus off. And, you know, those second units were being run by TJ McConnell. The Cavs offense is 11.6 points better with Garland on the court versus off. And those second units are being run by Donovan Mitchell. That is a different caliber of player than TJ McConnell, all due respect. The offense is 2 points better than the offense with Haliburton on last year. And as I said before, it goes up to 131 when it's just Garland and not Mitchell. So when you're talking about someone that is as productive per minute as any guard in the East, that is, you know, the focal point and the reason, the primary driver, the engine of the best feature of this team. Because as good as their defense is, they are winning with offense more than anything else. Darius is the engine of that. I think that he absolutely deserves to be an all-star for that reason.
And if you don't think so, Steve, you're just a hater.
Yeah.
Tuffy, the last thing you want to be known as in this space is a hater, as we all know.
That's Steve's brand.
And I'm known as an agenda pusher, so I had to say my piece here because, you know, I was tempted to say Evan too, but I really have been impressed by Mitchell's, you know, maturity, his leadership, and I just there are so many teams that have been collections of talent that haven't been more than the sum of their parts, and I think that's because everyone holds on to what makes them so special individually, and I think Mitchell's ability to adapt since he's come to Cleveland has blown me away. I was not a big Donovan Mitchell fan before he came to Cleveland, and the growth in his game year over year, the way that he has responded to them coming up short at times, the way that he's responded to his own success even and reflected upon that, I'm just really, really impressed by it.
Yeah. I gotta say, I love coming on this podcast and acting like either of you are not the most measured and thoughtful people. Right. It's one of my favorite bits to pretend like you have some nasty agenda. Yeah.
Just look at like the time, how much time is in every single podcast episode of the Dunker Spot, and then act like there isn't nuance with every single conversation. If you guys weren't putting a lot of thought and feeling into every single topic, these would be 45 minute episodes. This is part of why I love this podcast so much.
I appreciate y'all. I mean, hey, let the other people tell it. We just hate anyone that we do not shower with praise. So, you know, that's just naturally. The nature of the...
Naturally. Listen. But the dairy nature stuff is real, and Steve needs to grow up.
Yeah, grow up. Let's go to Steve. Stop fitting out. There we go. Hey, listen, we have found the pod title. We have done it. Friends, thank y'all again for hopping on. A happy new year again. Where can the people find you?
You know where to find podcasts. Wherever you found this podcast, search The Chase Down. You can also find us on YouTube. We go live twice a week on the Cavs YouTube channel. So subscribe and click that notification bell so you don't miss when we're going live.
Beautiful plug. Just casually on the Cavs YouTube channel. You know, as one does.
Yeah, it definitely is normal and not something that gives me anxiety before we go live every single time.
These two do tremendous work. Well, thank you, friends, for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us every Tuesday, the day after Monday, the day before Wednesday. We are on the Young Man the Three YouTube channel, formerly the JJ Reddit YouTube channel. So if you want to get the live reactions to my takes from Steve and his various faces when I give my takes, play spliced in, etc., check us out every Tuesday. Yeah, you can follow me on Blue Sky at Nikias NBA. Steve, as he said on the last episode, you are allowed to follow him on Blue Sky now. At Steve Jones 20. So check him out there. Join us for all Dunker Spot online watch parties. If you have a League Pass subscription, you can watch Hoops live with us. We have fun. We'll break down some clips. We also just let the hair down a little bit, the hair that we do have. We'll put some gaming up on stream. We've seen some Marvel. We've seen some Fall Guys, some College Football 25, some 2K. We do a little bit of everything. We'll sprinkle in some wrestling talk as well. So just a really chill space to be in. Come rock with us. Come have some fun. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.